What if we don't do all that other stuff, just simply doing the academic stuff?
Okay, colleagues, members of the audience, welcome to this Monday, April 29th, 2013 meeting of the House Committee on Higher Ed and Workforce Development. Hope you had a really good weekend and are ready for another fascinating week here in Salem. On the note of fascinating, we have two reports that we're going to be dealing with today, one having to do with textbooks and the other credit for prior learning. So with that, I'm going to open an information hearing on textbooks and textbook affordability. This is a report on House Bill 4059, was it? 40-something. Yeah, 4059 from last year, a task force that was created by this committee charge to the HEC to create this task force, and we are going to get a report on it today.
Precursor to this committee. She had a different number.
This committee always lives always.
Thank you.
4058. 4058? Okay, yeah. Great. For the record, 4058. Okay, so with that, the chair of that task force was Dr. James Woods, who is on the faculty, teaches economics at Portland State University. In his spare time, he chairs the Park Rose School Board, and he has a real interest in this subject, and we really appreciate his having taken a leadership role on, in pursuing the charge from the committee. And you all should have received or seen an OLIS, the report from the Task Force on Textbook Affordability. You might want to pull it up now. And Jamie, take it away, please. And Jamie, again, forget about your students. They're fine.
I'll go ahead and keep that in mind.
You're with us now.
Thank you very much. I just would like, before I start off, point out that this report wouldn't have been possible under the 3-month time frame that we had without the help of some interns that were at the Oregon University system. And so Alicia Miller and Sean Paulette were two people that really did make this thing possible, and they threw themselves into it. When we were looking at the other reports from other states, we found that they commonly had something on the order of 18 months, but we're Oregonians, and so we tend to do things faster and cheaper than they do in other states.
Thanks, Steve.
So let's go ahead and start off with some of the motivation. At first, it appeared that this was supposed to be strictly about textbooks, and so talking about those things that are made out of dead trees, but we found that this didn't necessarily make any sense. It was the same way of just looking at your gasoline usage without considering the vehicle, without considering where you live, where you work, and what it is that you're buying. So we expanded it to be all those things that are construction materials, including some things you may not know as construction materials. So it could be things like course management systems, which are used for test taking and grade propagation, question and answers that are there that are commonly online. Things like the mode that students are evaluated, whether they're on multiple choice tests, auto-graded online tests, whether they are essay exams, whether teaching assistants are there to bring those things. So all those other factors which play into your particular choice of a textbook, which is the collapsible component which the student is responsible for paying for outside tuition. And that's the key feature, is that lots and lots of people are making decisions filling up to this individual person having to pay for the consequences of everyone else's decision. So starting with that, we started looking into what are the causes of those cost increases are there. We had some public testimony which was a little bit contentious about were costs actually increasing. There was a little confusion on some people's parts between the difference between an expenditure survey and a price survey. But eventually that was resolved because we started looking at we started looking at some places where the cost drivers are that are earlier in the decision-making process. So if you go ahead and take a look at page 12, you'll see there, if instructors in large classes have no teaching assistants, you can see that we are actually starting with the decisions at the university level. We had a couple of required topics that we're supposed to look at. The first one was provision of the Higher Ed Authorization Act of 2008 that concerned textbook information. The shorthand summary is that while that was a, the intent was good, it was something that had absolutely no teeth whatsoever. And so all it was a good faith effort to go ahead and propagate information to students that was, you know, best they could practically do. And the bookstore managers throughout the Urban University system and the community colleges said that the adherence to this, making sure that the students had early knowledge of what the books were so that they could actually get some lower prices, was uneven and in general poor. I will go ahead and say, I'm quite embarrassed, in my own department of at least 16 people, there were only two that actually had their textbook information to the bookstore on time when I had started this particular process. Furthermore, if you go ahead and take a look at Portland State summer term, the deadline for summer terms textbook orders were on March 15th, and we didn't necessarily have budget or know what was being taught. And so at a certain institutional level, we're making it so that students cannot go ahead and find this information out in a timely manner. And that's just because of the lack of teeth that is in this particular provision. Moving on, we said that there were some possibilities.
Jamie, can I stop you there? Just for a sec. Colleagues, just for your information, that the law that Jamie was referring to, actually there's a federal version, and we as a state passed a similar version before the feds did. And what it does is it requires students to be aware of the textbook selections, as Jamie said, well in advance of the term so that they can look for online versions or, you know, discounted, used versions, you know, et cetera. The other piece of it had to do with making it really obvious to the instructor how much the book cost. It's not always evident when you're ordering a book how much the retail price will be. And a third piece of it banned the practice of the requirement that you have to purchase a bundled version of the textbook, that is where the print is accompanied by mandatory software and other workbooks, those kinds of things. Okay, sorry, Jamie.
Not a worry. We did focus, though, on the timeliness because of all the online resources available, if students have, you know, quite timely information, they can basically set a market order to make sure that a textbook is purchased for them at whatever price that they set, because these prices of textbooks, both new and used often, will fluctuate on a day-to-day basis. So it's a little spot market that's running there. And there are some large jumps. Again, we think it was possible for students to be able to save 20% if they had actually started in a timely manner. So, for example, there's a bunch of semester-oriented schools that are going to start going into finals fairly soon, and this would be a great time to start buying summer texts if you knew ahead of time that you were going to be going and purchasing those summer texts. And again, this was estimated to be a potential savings of about 20% that was there. With a couple of the other required topics, we were also asked to take a look at both purchasing of textbooks. It was determined roughly that it would add another layer of organization. We didn't find any cost advantage right there. Used book exchanges were also something where there was a significantly very deep for-profit market. So Amazon, Craigslist, Hack.com, Chegg, and others were very good for buying and selling text. And in fact, many of our students just have habitually purchase books on those particular networks. We also started looking at the possibility of lower cost and instructional materials, open source textbooks, and the like, because that was another required topic. We found that there were plenty that were in development, but the quality was highly uneven. There was one system that I believe was in Minnesota where there was actually reviews of them by faculty members to check their appropriateness. We were also tasked to go ahead and look at promotion of instructor-created open source resources. And to get to this one, we decided that it was possible, but it was one of those things that could be implemented at many different levels. Either the legislature could go ahead and put some small funds available to this. It could be something which the Art and Education Investment Board could do as part of their investment component. In fact, the HEC may be the one that actually organized these two contracts. Use of licenses and textbooks, and this is really getting into the way that textbooks now are different from textbooks when we were in school. Textbooks when we were in school is something which was a physical item that was there. We had the we were able to go ahead and resell it. We had ownership rights on it. But modern textbooks are often simply a licensing agreement. We only have access to them for 6 months, or we may have access to them in perpetuity, but only on certain devices that are kind of walled in. And this is what is causing so much trouble with students nowadays. So they don't have that secondary market of a used book. They can't go ahead and, after they're done with something, sell it for some additional benefit that somebody else actually gets. If they decide to retake a course, they have to basically relicense the material again, because these textbooks, quote unquote, are often bundled in with course management systems which are superior to those which are provided by the individual universities. And we have some ideas in the future topic section if you'd like to task us with investigating those. We also looked at some shared online materials, because it's another required topic, and for the most part it is, we required additional investigation on that. Use of textbook rentals, another one of the required topics. Again, there are many, many, many for-profit institutions doing it. In fact, all the entire ODS system is doing it. Students are regularly renting textbooks from places like Chegg and Amazon, for particularly their lower division courses, not necessarily their upper division courses, because often they are there for purchase. Peer-to-peer textbook sales, I think it was just about, every single bookstore in the U.S. system had a system for that, but they were not used very frequently. In fact, it was those other storefronts such as Chegg, Amazon, Hack.com that students were actually buying and selling textbooks. Moving down to the other required items, the publishing on demand was subject to something that an economist called the holdup problem. Portland State University Bookstore had a publish-on-demand system. There was little interest in participating on the publisher side. And what happened was that the royalties they demanded on the published works made it so that they had basically simply pushed the printing costs over to the local bookstore. So their margins were extremely high, and there was little, if any, cost savings to students. And then finally...
hold it, Jamie, can I hold you there? Mitch, you have a question?
I just don't understand what he just said. Could we try again?
Okay, could you rephrase that, Jamie, about the print-on-demand? I mean, what you said was that the publishers weren't really lowering their price, and so it was just pushing the paper costs, the printing costs, onto the bookstore?
That is correct. What happened was is that if you partition the cost of a book into two components, which is the printing cost and the royalty that's associated with it, what they were doing was taking, when they went to publishing on demand, they raised the royalty, so the price of the book had to be, to the student, the same as it was as if the publisher had actually printed it. So they had increased their margins, you know, just making it so that they were huge because all they had was all royalties, and then making it so there's no cost savings to the student, pushing the printing costs over to the local bookstore, who actually wasn't making any money on it then. Furthermore, the bookstore couldn't exactly keep the printing machine running at full speed all the time, and so it was a significant capital expense, and it actually resulted in increased cost to them.
Michael, can I?
Yes, Rep Greenlick.
I had a book published last year. Mm-hmm. It's 6x9 paperback, and the publisher was able to publish this book, which is essentially on demand anyhow, for less than $10, and sell it for $16.95 and make money. I mean, I just understand, are we giving authors a license to steal? I mean, literally, what's happening? Can they make the, any royalty?
It's the author's choice. It is the publisher's choice. And what you did is you chose, you know, you knew ahead of time what the printing costs were going to be. It was going to be $10. And you chose then a price which was going to be $16 or $26. It is as if you said, well, look, if I'm going to go ahead and have it printed on demand, the licensing fee is going to go for the difference between $26 and $10, $16. We're going to go ahead and jack the licensing fee up to $26 if you're going to go ahead and print it, making it so that it was almost exactly the same price. But again, it's the publisher's decision, not necessarily the author's decision.
And remember, this is the textbook wing of the operation, which is different than...
I understand.
Yeah.
I don't understand, but...
Okay, go on, Jamie, please.
We talked about also the partnerships, and it was, let's see, there were so many other initiatives that were going on in other states that we almost couldn't gather them in the 3 months that we had available. And this is where I have to, you know, almost point out again, is that other states had, you know, 18 months to put this together. We were moving fast, and we had to go ahead and do a quick triage on the issues that were there. Our current recommendations are, generally speaking, things that try to put the university's incentives in line with the student incentives again. And so we put together a couple of quick ideas. The first ones had to do with making sure that there was greater alignment with this Higher Ed Authorization Act of 2008, making sure that there was the books were known to the students in a timely manner so that they have a chance of saving that 20%. It's definitely possible. And so we put in some model policy that was in there. And the model policy made it so that it was at a level higher than the individual faculty member that they go ahead and create a mechanism where there would be default books put into place should you went ahead and pass up the deadline. So this means the defaults could be things like the same text and same readings that you had last time or something along those lines. But the idea was to make it so that the job was taken care of above the faculty member should the faculty member not have. During the first term that I actually play tested this in my department, our adherence to having things on time jumped to 100%. And this was just one of the mechanisms that we had there. This did not, however, fix the problem of having university budgets and those higher-level decisions on hiring get in the way. So, for example, again, summer term has the same difficulty with a huge number of books will be all, ordered at the last minute, and students simply don't have time to react to those price changes that are available. We also had the possibility of some feedback mechanisms to make it so that it was publishable and embarrassing when we found that institutions couldn't actually produce this kind of information on time. We had a couple of mechanisms. Mechanism number one was for the Oregon Education Investment Board to make it as one of the reported cost drivers that they have in the compacts. Currently, the compacts are in fairly basic form, focusing mostly on things like degrees granted and the like, but this could be something that could be reported on those. The information is, in fact, already collected by the bookstores, and so you know what kind of adherence you do have. The second thing that's possible is that there is some space in the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program where a small change could be made to have this being reported through that institution. And again, it was just a possibility we had there for the Common Report. And again, that was just trying to get the feedback. We also looked at some other mechanisms, and we were attacking the textbook cost at the faculty level. And what we had was a mechanism which is in place at some of the non-profit universities, where basically a bounty is given to faculty members to lower the cost of textbooks to students through you know, specific, but, you know, good means. And if they did so for a certain length of time, they were going ahead and given this particular bounty. But furthermore, they were also given an expert to help them do it. So somebody who was very aware of the online resources that were there, somebody who was very aware of how copyright works at the library, so you have things which you don't have to pay additional copyright fees on, and other ways of making it so it's at lower cost to students. This particular bounty method is also used at Lane Community College, as I found out afterwards through communication with their academic dean. And this is something that could be funded at individual university level. It could be funded at the State Board of Higher Ed. It could be funded by the Oregon Educational Investment Board or through you, legislature. We also had some recommendations for future study, some of which had interest, were extremely long-term. The first and most interesting one was taking a look at the ways that fees were charged for courses. And currently, all textbook fees are something which are separate. The individual student pays them themselves. But if you take a look at one of the lessons from Western governors, is that they have a basically all-you-can-eat, all-inclusive system for fees. So all textbooks are included in the price of the classes that they take there. This could be extended to courses at universities. I have an extremely high fee, which is intended to go ahead and cover all those instructional materials. And the incentives to reduce the cost could be completed by making it so that the students could go ahead and take the cost of their particular instructional materials, go to the department itself as the one who induced them to produce to purchase those materials, and receive, say, 80% of the cost back from them in the cost-sharing contract. And in a cost-sharing contract like that, when the, say, academic department has an incentive to reduce costs in some ways on the textbooks, can then go ahead and take those funds available to do things which also provide academic benefits to the students. So, for example, teaching assistants, lab hours, a better course management system for, say, the academic division. And this was this idea was taken up by the former chancellor before the change in management that was there. We also were looking at the creation of some open source resources, wikis, and the like, but what we're missing here was the component that had to do with evaluation, which we're all missing on this. You will also note that there is this blending and blurring of what constitutes a textbook and what constitutes a course. And this feeds into the entire huge discussion of MOOCs, those massively online courses, where some are saying that this is just a slightly hopped-up textbook, others are saying that this is a substitute for an instructor, and so we're having a particular difficulty trying to turn these things into a textbook. We could also go ahead and play into a series of incentives in the educational compact by the creation of a true instruction materials cost index. Given that the bookstores are collecting this information, constructing these things wouldn't be all that difficult. I mean, use methodology, which is quite similar to which is currently used in the chain CPI. And this would stop some of the controversy that we had with the textbook industry preferring to use a cost index, while the student groups were preferring to use price index, but the price index only included new textbooks and didn't include all the other instructional materials. We also did not have time to do a full review of existing policies, not just at the Oregon University system, but throughout. And one of the great things about having all these nonprofits is that they have very innovative policies in some areas, things that can be shared and brought from institution to institution. We didn't have time to explore all those specific policies. A couple of the community colleges are working on making sure that there's reserved texts, which are useful if students are, again, buying those textbooks online. It gives them some lag time after the start of the term, compensating for, you know, those potentially missed deadlines on making sure that the texts are there, and gives them a greater opportunity to get some slightly cheaper prices. The other extreme long-term ones are basically taking the Netflix model and trying to apply it for textbooks. What is extremely painful about textbook rentals is that a textbook rental can cost you $40 or $50 for the term, and for the same cost, you can watch hundreds upon hundreds of movies on Netflix or Hulu. And so clearly there's kind of a disconnect between these two models. And so we suggest that it is possible to make a negotiation with the textbook publishers, similar to what Netflix and others have done for the movie and, you know, TV industry, to take a whole package and make them available to the students. But this would be something which would, again, go through the individual schools, or perhaps a group which would provide these services to all higher ed students in Oregon. And then finally, we had a difficulty dealing with the idea of custom editions, which were frequently cited as a way of decreasing cost to students. These are essentially books which have chapters which are omitted that the instructor doesn't intend on using. And while the first cost to the student may be lower, it produces an extremely thin secondary market for the books, so they can't be sold outside. They can't be sold on Amazon because it is very specific to that instructor and makes it nearly impossible to provide used books to students except through those very limited exchanges which are on campus. So I think that was the fastest version of this I have ever done.
That was excellent, Jamie. Thank you. So we have a couple of questions. Representative Gallegos?
Permission to use a visual aid.
Okay.
I'm teaching a course this summer, just a psychology seminar, and I ordered this book. It weighs a ton, but...
Could you speak up so I can share?
Sure, yeah. I'm just saying I ordered this book that I'm showing the audience now. It's a psychology, basic psychology textbook. And, boy, you know, it's a Cengage publication. And you're right, I got a whole box full of stuff with it, videos and slideshows and all kinds of stuff that go with it. But, you know, on Amazon, I saw it the other day, this book cost $248. $248. And if you think that an average term is like, you know, five courses, so that's, $2,500 per semester. $5,000 a year. What's that? $20,000 for books to get through school. So I'm just appalled, literally, at the cost of books. It's just incredible. My question really has to do with not just books. I'm curious if you thought about, considered the whole issue of the total learning experience, and what happens to the role of the instructor. I'm finding, what I found in the last few years of teaching was that I almost became superfluous, irrelevant. Because there's the slideshows, there's the videos, there's all kind of, there's the tests that come with this stuff. What do we need instructors for? Certainly, my point, though, is that we need less to rely on the knowledge base of our faculty, because these publishers, I mean, literally, they put out course outlines. I mean, the instructors hardly have to do anything. So I'm just curious about, again, the role of the faculty in making decisions about what to use to teach, how to teach, how much of this technology do they really need? I guess that's my question. Did you think about that or consider that?
Jump into a very large area.
Right, and colleagues, we are time limited here, so okay. We're going to have to wrap up in about 5 minutes.
You have to remember that faculty members are subject to their own perverse incentives. If you're talking about those which are at the community college level, their promotion is dependent upon research output. Basically, teaching consists of, you know, did you get in trouble or were your scores below a certain minimum threshold which no one gets? no, then you're doing just fine. You know, things are going on with service. And so from an individual faculty member's point of view, if they're on the tenure track in those institutions, teaching is just something that you need to go ahead and minimize the time that you have available.
Exactly.
That's the way that the institution runs it right now. As far as what you're doing to teach your students, you could have reduced the cost of that huge book by stepping back to an earlier edition. You could go ahead with those readers, making sure that you were into the library in order to make sure that you were using the things that they already had access to through JSTOR, so that was something which was definitely reducible. As far as your place in this, it is you are responsible for curating all the content that's there, because you don't have to stick with a certain provider. And you're also there to generate that content, too. In my own courses, I have a YouTube channel, and I thought YouTube was going to be purely for cats or something along those lines. But my short snippets in my courses have over 100,000 hits. And so I create things that are specific for my courses, knowing that they're attuned to what point I'm trying to get across, or showing them how to work certain kinds of problems, or certain kinds of procedure is repetitive, and creating something which I believe is a better representation of the idea that I'm trying to get across. And so I create a lot of those things too. So besides the curation, you're also doing creation at the same time. Your primary goal, though, is going to be diagnosis of what the student's difficulty is in understanding the topic. And it has always been that way. It's just that that's been secondary because we've been so focused on an individual text and a lecture. And I feel it's freeing us up for our highest and best use.
Thank you. Rep. Greenlick, and then we'll have to wrap it up.
Thank you, Ms. I've been on this committee struggling with this all the way back to the Mundeling thing, and it just is extraordinarily frustrating. It makes me feel like there's a sort of silent conspiracy among faculty members to help other faculty members deal with the fact that they're not paid enough money so they can make money on the royalties. I mean, I just would never have used a textbook that cost $250. I just wouldn't do it. I'd find some other way to do it, and it seems to me the faculty need to take some real responsibility for figuring out how to deliver the product in a just much more efficient way. $250. I've watched my grandkids now in college, although I haven't been teaching in the last few years, and they do spend more than $1,000 a semester, sometimes $2,000 for textbooks. It's just outrageous. There are material that you can use to teach a course that doesn't cost $250 a book.
Right.
And it's really up to the faculty, it seems to me, to get with this.
Yeah, I will say, yeah. Go ahead, Jamie.
I was going to say, I understand you fully, and I'm one of those faculty members that does walk the talk. I've got one class where the textbook cost was $12 plus shipping, and another one where it was $20. And I tell my students, you know, straight ahead, this is what I'm trying to do. This is just a part of the educational material I have on your way. But I will emphasize that the incentives that are there for fixed-term faculty members are to publish and to minimize what you're doing in the classroom. It is, the classroom thing is a checkoff as far as their performance goes. It's not something which ever provides them with much of any benefit as far as their promotion possibilities.
Yes. Now, this is obviously an ongoing struggle. I think it's, I assume, Rep. Gallegos, when you chose your textbook, that the cost of that book was not obvious on the front page.
Right.
And that is still a problem. Faculty are not being given the information that they need. As Jamie says, the institutions are not yet incentivizing faculty for bringing those costs down, and there've got to be ways to do that. You know, I myself, I'll be teaching one course this summer. The cost will be zero because I've developed all my own materials, but I know that, and so our two classes together, the student will have an average cost of $100. That's still, for many students, that's a lot of money, and we really need to continue to get on top of that. And Jamie, I apologize for the short timeline that we put your task force on, but you know, our hope was that this would be ongoing work. And I really appreciate the recommendations that you made. And I do hope that the HEC will continue to monitor and to work on this issue. So with that, Jamie, thank you very much. And
thank you very much.
Go back to your class and enjoy Portland State. Okay. So
thank
with
you.
That, I'm going to, oh, well, I guess I don't have to.
Close the information
hearing. All right. I close the information hearing on textbook affordability, and I'll open the informational hearing on credit for prior learning. Jerry? So here's the results of another task force that this committee in its wisdom charged the HEC with. Jerry, thank you very much. If you would just introduce yourself and your various titles for the record, that would be great.
Well, for the record, my name is Gerald Hamilton, and I found my way on the Credit for Prior Learning Advisory Committee as by virtue of being on the State Board of Education. I thank you for this opportunity to share what I think is an exciting committee doing yeoman's work in the area of credit for prior learning. I call them very smart, industrious, and committed folks who meet monthly and are investing a sizable amount of time. And what's really interesting about this group is that they're from all four sectors of higher education. And, you know, getting in a room talking seriously about how do we bring that together. I know you have a copy of the report that we filed. The report, I think, was a great piece of work for its time. Again, we were on a fairly short timeline to get that report. My first meeting was November 1st, and so there was a few days to get that done. What we did find in that document that of our analysis of the activities that the community colleges, OUS, and private and independents are doing, that they all are really doing something for prior learning. The problem is that it is all over the place to some degree, to use that term lightly. It is very varied and dependent on the location. And if you look at that matrix, and I think that's in the report as well, you'll see some work in a community college around the CASE grant. That was a large grant received for the community college. It's working on how do we do something with that. The OUS system has a task force that is working very hard on faculty mostly, but that have actually come to our meetings and been involved at some levels on how they're going to respond. Joe Holliday is on our committee, who is working with that committee, so we have a direct connection to them. And some great work done at Merrillhurst by Melanie Booth and how the independents are dealing with that. But it really was around the world in terms of being coordinated. So what we did with that report, I think, is put together a group of findings that you'll find in the report. And I'm doing this quickly because as we get along, we'll talk about where we have continued, and we'll talk about what we're doing. But the report talked about communication and various things, cost and so forth, and I'll let you read those findings. But I would have to say the number one finding that we found is we have a whole lot more work to do that we can do in 90, you know, 60 days or less. And so the committee has continued to meet. We see this as a multi-year job. You know, it's not going to get done. And we have made significant progress in the last, you know, 5 months of meetings. We meet monthly for an entire morning. And during that meetings, once we got the report done, we said, well, where do we go from here? We've got the report that gives a set of findings that talk about what we need to publicize it more and all that. But that really didn't get to the crux of how do we build a system for prior learning in Oregon. That just didn't get there. So we recognized that each one of us at the table had a different perspective of what that was. You know, we didn't have that foundational understanding of what credit for prior learning really even was, you know, coming from all those different sectors. So what we did is we brought in Melanie Booth from Elmhurst, who has done enormous international work on credit for prior learning and happens to be a committee member. And we brought in Joel Martin from Chemeketa. So we got two approaches. We got an independent approach. We got a community college approach on how do they run it? How do they assess it? How do they put together their programs at their colleges that do award credit for prior learning? And it was really an interesting day, and I won't speak to the other committee members, but at least one light bulb went off, and that was mine. Because, I mean, I was able to say, I was able to learn what it was. I mean, I finally had a foundation. I'd read, the Wikipedia-type definitions, and I'd worked in it. I've been a past community college president, so I knew what it was. We had done, some crediting around military training and all of that kind of thing, and worked very hard to try to bring that up. But I didn't know the depth and breadth, I don't think. And that really gave us a foundation. So, and provide us direction for what is our future work. And so where do we go from there? What we did was we started to build what we call a strategies document, or I like to call an action plan. That's part of what we do in the organizations is build action plans, which are outline our activities, outline a timeline, outline our accountabilities to get things done. And so I think you have a copy of our action plan that was just given to you today. And you'll see that under every goal we have outlined activities that we intend to do in a timeline that we're under to get them done. The most significant action that we've taken, we have put together a policy and standards work group that is a joint effort between our committee and the Joint Boards of Articulation, called JBAC. You may have heard the word JBAC. Yeah, there's an acronym for everything. That are really going to start putting, that are working, and we're meeting this month on a policy statement and a set of standards that can be endorsed and embraced by all four sectors of higher education. We've embraced the
worst type. Excuse me, Jerry.
Yes, please.
Rick Wilson.
Yes.
Mr. Hamilton, yes. Doctor, is it doctor? Dr. Hamilton?
No, just Mr. is fine.
Okay. Would you go back and you said four people have to endorse it? What did you mean?
Well, the four sectors, of which are, we want to do something that really is inclusive of the community colleges, the OUS system, the independents, and private colleges.
Okay, thank you.
And so these, we want everybody to be able to put together, a loose, tight kind of philosophy that has been embraced, that's loose enough for everybody to do, but that gives direct guidance on what it is, how it works, and some standards, so that the credit, once it is transcript, is valuable.
Follow up to that,
please. Yes, please.
I think that's good, but we don't have to have the private part of it to direct or to have a policy for the unit of state. Is that correct?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative, I understand that, but I think they are at the table and they are committed to try to build that system. And I think, as long as we've got them there, we're going to try to work together to be able to accomplish that as a whole. Because, students transfer. Mm-hmm. What we want to make sure is that when transfer credits happen, and that there is a common knowledge, common understanding, and a willingness to accept those credited classes.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you for the question. What we see is this group, getting back to the group, also working on the implementation strategies, promising practices, and guidelines for awarding credit. Because clearly that those issues are important, as we talked about in transfer. In the future, and as recently as, or as quickly as next week or the week after, Don always reminds me when the meetings are, keeps me on track. We will be looking to bring students to talk about barriers. What are the barriers? What are student barriers? We've done some work around that we can share if you'd like, around what do students see when they go from the student's perspective to people's websites or to the college material, and is it available? Is it something that they can navigate? So what we want to do is outline those barriers so that we can start working a system to get ready to do something about that. And so bringing students in seems to be a real important piece of that work and finding that out. And so That will happen. And then I think after that, we'll move on to the assessment systems and how do you assess prior learning. And we have to keep in mind that the Kale standards and some of, you know, I always have to look what Kale means. It's an acronym for the national group that really works on experiential learning, which prior learning is a piece of, recognizes that prior learning it's about learning, not about experiences. So we have to have a way to assess the learning and not just the experiences. And many times, one of the things that I learned, just as a side note, you know, because you had a great experience doing X, Y, and Z, and you come to a community college or an OUS system college, you know, there may be pieces of that required learning to meet those outcomes of those colleges that you have not had. And what we saw oftentimes is there was an actual class that students had to go in, and that and during that class, they were able to write or demonstrate through a portfolio system that they had this piece of learning and that they'd done the research oftentimes on the theoretical backing for their experiences. And so they had to look at that breadth, and you saw classes that allowed these people and gives them some assistance on being able to put that together. But we want to look at assessment systems. Trying to look at assessment systems with a sense that not everybody's system is going to be the same, but there's going to be some commonality amongst those assessment systems so that students can transfer from where I was a president of Klamath to University of Oregon or someone else and expect that their assessment of their learning is accepted and is valuable. I was also asked to talk a little bit today about the military acceptance of military training, and to make sure that we are on board with that, we have recently added a committee member from the military, so that she keeps us on track and keeps us moving in the right direction. What we perceive the military to be is a very important piece of prior learning, very, very important. But have chosen to look at it in the context of the total learning, total sum of prior learning. That as a student comes to a college, has had certainly very, very, very valuable military learning. Certainly can demonstrate that very quickly through the systems that we're building for all learning that could happen before they come. So we haven't really singled military training out, but clearly it is going to be dealt with and dealt with in the context of the what is the notion of the prior learning concept.
Mr. Chair?
Excuse me.
Yes, sir.
Yes, Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you. Just point of clarification, Jerry. your work group probably didn't, but the legislature did kind of single out military training. Senate Bill 275 was kind of the culmination. Was it Thursday? Thursday afternoon, I think, was Carissa Caldwell and Clackamas Community College and Central Oregon Community College did a presentation to the Veterans Committee as an update that we had requested on how credit was going for military training and schooling, and that's done through ACE. And actually, I was sitting here thinking of that presentation from just last week in what you're presenting, and I'm thinking about the challenges of the differences, because if you got your military record that you present to college or university, you know, they can kind of go down the line, okay, this MP training is worth this,
right?
And it's more prescriptive, where what you're delving into is probably quite a bit more subjective, and so trying to come up with a strategy to develop credit for that is maybe a little more challenging, because you don't maybe have the infrastructure that ACE has.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heffman, let me explain how I've come to learn, and I certainly think Krista and others probably have far more knowledge than I do in this. But ACE really works with the courses and how the military courses translate to the colleges. And what we've looked at is that individual, the individual who comes to us with XYZ training. How are we going to deal with that individual? And unlike ACE, which deals with like courses and outcomes of courses, and aligning outcomes of courses to military training, And if we look at an assessment system that we've kind of have envisioned, it is for that individual who comes and says, you know, I did X, Y, and Z, and it really, ACE really hasn't, you know, it doesn't exactly fit in the mold that ACE is working with. How are we going to get that individual credit? You know, how do we assess that prior work that they've done and through in a portfolio or something to make sure that they get the credit for the work that they've got?
Mm-hmm. And if I could follow up, you know, the genesis of this, you know, the charge to the HEC was actually a presentation at WICHE that I was able to be part of, where CALE, the Council on Adult and Experiential Learning, has been partnering with ACE, American Council on Education, to take that, you know, the non-course learning that people have done and to translate it into an ACE-type course credit. It's a really interesting project that they have going on.
Right. But I do agree, Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, it is a very complicated thing and one that we're wrestling with. I mean, yeah. I understand.
Rick Nagels.
Yeah, I find this all fascinating, especially if you go back to the 70s. I was part of getting a college accredited with a College Without Walls curriculum, which was kind of popular back in those days. But I also am aware that there was a strong reaction to that credit for, you know, previous learning experiences and so on. And it was almost like, you know, you didn't touch that kind of learning. I'm curious whether your personal opinion is this really a cost saving sort of interest rather than, and if so, are we looking at this at the cost of watering down our educational quality? And I guess I just have concerns about that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Guys, I don't believe that's true at all. I mean, what we are really trying to do is to make sure that we have an assessment system that meets the standards of the credit. If you look at the college accreditation system that all the public colleges go through, there are policy statements about credit for prior learning that we have to adhere to maintain accreditation, But if you look at the systems that are at Chemeketa and Melhurst, they are very, very dynamic and do require, you know, a high level of responsibility of the student to demonstrate that they have the knowledge and to really beef up the knowledge if they're short in some places. If you talk about cost, I personally believe, and the reason that I was excited to be on this committee, you know, personally was that if we are really going to make 40-40-20, and that is our goal, and I believe strongly in that goal. I think that's for education. I mean, I've been in the public schools 37 years as both a public school superintendent and a community college president. We have to be able to do that. I mean, that's the right thing to do for our students. You know, we have to look at all of the learning that takes place. You know, those of us that were, you know, that served in other roles before we went to college, there was a mass of learning there. We just have to make sure that it meets the standards, meets the outcomes. In terms of cost, I think it is much cheaper for the student. But, I mean, we were presented with students that were taking a one-hour class and walking away with six and eight, nine credits because they were able to do that work that were present. Now you're talking about cost of the institution. I'm not sure that it's less expensive for the institution because some of them will have to build a system to do that. I mean, that doesn't come without people and a system for prior learning. But on the other hand, you know, it is valuable. You know, and every institution out there wants to do what's best for the students, and this is a great help. As I see it from a community college perspective, I mean, the average age of my student was 28 years old. Mm-hmm. You know, those people have life experiences before they came to college.
Follow-up?
Yes,
It's a bit like a comment and then a question. I you know, yes, the 40-40-20 is a goal, but I don't think that numeric goal should take the place of quality of education. I think that's just as critical as getting those numbers. That's just a comment. The question I have is, in your process, to what degree has the Northwest Accrediting Association been part of the discussion or the process at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gallegos, they we certainly have done research around their policy. We have, I mean, I know that the chairman has come to the HEC, and we've had personal conversations around it. We are very aware of that. Those of us that have gone through accreditation visits on the team are very aware of what those policies and standards that they submitted are required. So I would just say that that's where we are.
There, yeah.
You know, we run, everything we do through is going to have to run through that lens.
And let me just follow up. I mean, it is a challenge to expansion of credit for prior learning because, as I understand it, the accrediting agencies do put a limit on how many credits a student can have through credit for prior learning. And what is the limit?
You know, I'm sorry, I don't have that information.
25%.
25%.
Okay. That's great help.
Sorry. 25%, and that is a topic of ongoing national debate, I think. You know, some people would like the accrediting agencies to loosen up that number. Others would like it to remain in place. It's a national debate. You know, I think that the key here also is, and I really appreciate the fact that the sectors are meeting together, is because the core issue is going to have to be around transferability, right? You know, that is, if Shemeketa is giving credit for prior learning, you know, that's the equivalent of Psych 101, for example, that course is going to have to transfer somewhere if a person ultimately wants a four-year degree. Will PSU accept it? Will Reed College accept it? Will, you know, Linfield accept it, et cetera? And so that's where the rubber hits the road on this issue and where quality is somehow going to have to be guaranteed.
Well, and Mr. Chair, that's why we're working very hard on that policy standards. I mean, we believe a set of standards that may be loose, but everybody can embrace will put us in good stead for that kind of issue.
Great. Thanks. Vice Chair Huffman.
A comment and a question. I can appreciate what Representative Gallegos is saying, but I guess where I've always been fascinated with credit for prior learning is that you've got an individual that's been out in the working world for 20 years, and they've actually done the creative writing or something as a part of their job that their talents at this point in their career could far supersede what they would have learned in writing 101 or whatever, or a used car salesman that has for 20 years used psychological and subliminal tactics that far supersede what they ever learned in Psych 101. Just as an example, I sold used cars at one point in my life. All my mother's proud. I car sales politician. I've just really,
you haven't
really
gone, you haven't gone very far, right?
Really messed her up. I sold Aaron. Sold Aaron there somewhere too. It is there the capability of bundling? If there's say a 25% cap on the prior learning, would that affect the ACE military credit also, or can that be bundled to end up with 50% of?
I don't, Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, I don't believe that's the case, but I would want to check that to make sure.
That the case.
I don't believe it's bundable. Is it,
I don't think it is, but that's Representative Huffman.
Donna, no more. Why don't you come up and introduce yourself?
No. Sorry about that. For the record, my name is Donna Welling with the Oregon Department of Community Colleges and help staff the advisory to Representative Denbro and Vice Chair Huffman. It's my understanding that they are not bundable, that the 25% is the cap for both, but that would be part of the importance of having additional conversation with the accrediting body just to ensure that we have an accurate understanding.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, I think the issue for us, I believe it is that Don is correct. You know, we just have to be real sure, and that's what makes this really complicated, that the car salesman who may have a world of marketing behind them, you know, has marketing marketed cars for 20 years, also is able to demonstrate the theoretical background of marketing, who may not have had that. And so when we set up that assessment system, we need to validate that experience, but also take it to the next level to make sure that those outcomes of those courses at the higher ed level are being obtained. That's the issue.
Thank you. Rep. Wisman.
Thank you, because we're going to run short of time, Mr. Chair. Okay, I think we've got some good work here, but is it ended now? Dr. Hamilton said he's going to continue, but do we have to give him policy, or how is this going to continue? Because you haven't mentioned the Western Governors University in any compact with them. I still understand who sets the 25% maximum. And then, because if that's prior learning or military courses that have been accredited through the ACE and things like this, I mean, I'm still not certain about.
Well,
and also the final comment is, how many universities in Oregon are already doing this? I mean, they've got Maryhurst is, that's one of their big things, George Fox, you look at Western Oregon, Eastern Oregon, they're all doing it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilson, everybody's doing it in some way, shape, or form, but there's no commonality and there's no universal kind of practice or policy or standards for what's going on. Now, and I won't say everybody's doing it because not everyone doing it, but many, many, many are. And if you look at the matrix we did in the report, it kind of speaks to that. I think the issue for us is we are not finished. You know, we intend to continue this no matter what happens. We know that, you know, and I'm certainly not, in the loop, but I know HEC is the whole HEC thing is kind of up in the air a bit now. But this is important, and I think everyone on that committee is very committed to staying and seeing this through. We didn't see that because we filed the report in December of last year, we were done. I mean, we just knew that we couldn't. And what I'm giving you today is only a milestone progress report along the line, and I'd welcome a chance to come back and at the end of the year and do that again, or in February when you're back together.
Right. And following up on Rep. Wisman's question, it's great that you're going to continue to meet. I will say that the work of your task force, as well as the textbook one, is why we created the HEC in the first place. Why the HEC did we create this thing? You know, it's to do exactly this cross-sector kind of work, focusing on removing barriers for students. I think it's really, really important. The question will be, for this work, are you at some point going to need more statutory direction or, you know, legislative direction? And, you know, if so, it would be great if we could get that in, you know, well in advance of the February session so we can develop legislation around it.
Mr. I'm not sure I'm in the area to be able to comment on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rep. Gallegos, and then we're going to have to wrap.
Yeah, just one more question or comment. I'm thinking that
do a priority bill.
You know, that 25% business, that seems like an arbitrary number. If we have the logic and the, you know, rationale behind this, and it just seems to me that, again, working with the accreditation folks to clarify this some more would be really helpful.
Mr. Chair, I think we have to have before we can have that conversation, we need to have every I dotted and every T crossed.
Exactly.
That's the way creditors work. And so I see maybe down the line that will happen.
It also sort of falls in line with what's happening with education. We're moving more toward performance-based outcomes as opposed to content, knowledge. It's just a fascinating sort of evolution that I think that will continue to follow.
Colleagues, we will be having a session on schools of education sometime in the next couple of weeks, and you know, that this whole area is also, I think, a subject that I'd like to probe with them. I'm thinking, just based on today's conversation, we might at one point, either during this session or during the interim, want to bring in the accrediting agency just to talk about accreditation and the relationship, you know, the role of accreditation. I think that would be useful. Okay, thank you very much, Jerry and Donna. Very, very informative, and thanks for your ongoing work.
Thank you for having us.
Great. And so with that, I'm going to close this Informational meeting on credit for prior learning. Colleagues, Wednesday we go to Central Oregon, is that right?
Yep.
And Friday we go to Eastern Oregon without ever having to leave Salem. So look forward to that. No, 8:45, sir. Okay, with that, we are adjourned.